Good evening. My name is Max Whalen. I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, Dickinson College, the Churchill Fund, the Departments of Economics, Sociology, International Business and Management, and the Women's Center, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's event, Lifting the Floor and Achieving Gender Equality. While women have always done much of the work that keeps society going, their access to the formal market economy has traditionally been restricted. Initially, society legally excluded women from many occupations on the basis of stereotypes about female nature. Over the last century, women activists have fought many battles to have these legal barriers removed. The movement culminated in the 60s and 70s as the second wave feminist movement peaked. Many argue, however, that the removal of formal barriers has not been enough. The wage gap, the glass ceiling, sexual harassment, and cultural expectations lead many to claim that the playing field is still unequal. Tonight's speaker, Dr. Heidi Hartmann, is an expert on how women have fared in the workplace. She's a research professor at the George Washington University, the president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and the co-author of several reports on the state of women in the economy. She's currently the co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics and Policy, and is on the editorial board of Feminist Economics. Dr. Hartmann has received a PhD from Yale, honorary doctorates from Claremont Graduate University and Swarthmore College, and has received a MacArthur Fellowship for her work in the field of women in economics. At this time, I'd like to ask that you please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. A question and answer session will follow, so please hold your queries until then. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Heidi Hartmann.
Thanks, Max. I think I have two microphones, and I'm going to be using this one, so I hope that one doesn't bother anyone. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be back at Dickinson College. I think I was last here about 4 years ago, and I have many friends here, and so it's always a nice honor to be back, and I'm especially pleased to be the guest of the Clark Forum, which seems to be a great program that you have here. You have many opportunities to meet with people who come in from outside that are presumably doing things in the real world to give you an idea of what might your futures might be as you proceed with your careers. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all very much for the invitation. Tonight I want to do three things. I want to talk about women in the labor market. Some of you might have heard some of this 4 years ago, so I'm just going to zip through that. And then I want to talk about poverty and low-wage work and the special ways in which that affects women. And then lastly, look at this recession and the recovery and how women and men have fared differently in the recession and the recovery, and whether the recovery programs are working as well for women as they are for men. We've done a fair amount of research at the Institute for Women's Policy Research about this recession and this recovery. And interestingly, it is very different for men and women, and I can honestly say that nobody really knows exactly why or understands why. It's one of those relatively unexamined areas in economics. You may know, even those of you who are not economics majors, that you know macroeconomics is usually considered to be the study of the larger economy and of the economic growth and the business cycles. And in 2004, 2005, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in its wisdom, decided to eliminate a data set for women. And they have something called the payroll survey. They collect data from businesses in all the states, hundreds of thousands of businesses, and they ask them, how many workers on your payroll? The second question is, how many of those workers are women? The third question is, what is their average pay? How many hours a week do they work? And so on. And in 2005, the Bureau of Labor Statistics decided to eliminate the second question, how many of those workers are women? So you can imagine that the women's movement got a little upset about that, and we sort of, as a think tank, joined with some of the women's groups, including Republican-leaning business women's groups, who were very annoyed about it, and we actually got an amendment on the floor of the House to the labor appropriations bill that year that required the BLS to put that data set back. But when we were meeting with the BLS, which was a meeting organized by the Office of Management and Budget, and I invited in some economists from around the country to say, you know, why we thought this was very important, one of the things I said was that the study of gender in macroeconomics was in its infancy, And there may be gender differences in the recession and the business cycle. And, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, somebody might look back and be able to say, hey, you know, in 2025, we didn't have a recession because we understood the gender differences and we saw some leading indicators and we kept from having a recession. And the man who is now the acting commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics laughed when I said that. Well, that was actually turned out to be a very good thing because some of the staff people from Congress were there because we had already alerted them. And when they heard that guy laugh, they were really, really insulted and angry. Because all these feminist economists had come in from around the country, and here is this guy laughing at us. So that's why we got our data set back. So because we got that data set back, just in case you didn't know it, men lost a lot more jobs in this recession than women. If we hadn't gotten that data set back, nobody would actually have known that. Or they wouldn't have known it at the time. They would have been able to find it out a year or two later from other data sets. So it was a very instructive thing because I kept saying, but all economists agree that this is the data set you must use to study the business cycle, month by month employment. And they said, yes, yes, we know you have to study that to study the business cycle. So if we want to study women in the business cycle, we need this data set. Oh, no, no, you can get that from another data set. I'm like, no, we can't. You've already told us that that data set is no good to study month by month data. Well, that doesn't matter. You can find out what you need to know about women over there. And so that was just, you know, it was like, a very interesting conversation. But thanks to Senator Kennedy, we kept that data set, and so we've been able to do a lot of work about the recession. So my last topic will be how women and men have been faring in the recession and whether the American Recovery and Act has helped at all and who it's helped and why. This is just telling you a little bit about the institute that I founded 25 years ago. We basically do social science research and ask a gender-based question to try to achieve change for women. These are some of the areas that we work in. You can see a lot of them are economic in, of nature. And this is the first part of my talk, talking about how things have progressed for women in the labor market. And there really are enormous changes. When I joined the labor market, that was in 1967, the year I graduated from college, and now these are in slightly wrong order, so I have to skip a bunch of slides. Here we go. You can see this slide starts in 1950 and goes to 2010. The vertical blue lines are the periods of recession, and 1967 is right about where the word women is. So that's about when I graduated from college and joined the labor force, about 40% of women were working compared to 90% of men. And you can imagine that in a major like economics, it had even fewer women then than it has now, which is not very many. I was pretty much outnumbered and, you know, always just sort of one of the few, hardly any women. In my graduate studies at Yale University, which I went to a couple years later, there were 40, actually, students in my entering economics class. Four of us were women. So it was that kind of time. It was before the Civil Rights Act, 1964, had just been passed. But it was before a very important law for women that a lot of you might know about, not know about, but it is in your brochure, I see, for tonight's lecture, the 1978 Pregnancy Discrimination Act. I can tell you that in the labor market in 1967, you know, I worked with many different women, often secretaries. They would get pregnant, and they would quit work, and they would go home. And typically, they in this era, they would not go back to work until after their children were older. But why did they quit work? Well, mostly because they knew there would be no job for them if they said, I'd like to work after my baby is born, because that was just not done. You didn't want to run the risk of looking stupid, I think, and say you would like to work because your employer would say, well, no, you know, that's not going to happen. And so when people say to me, well, what kind of maternity leave was there in the United States? I said, well, it was known as marriage. You had to be... You had to be married because you had to have a husband who was earning money because you were not going to keep earning money. And that is really the way it was then. And it's kind of hard to think of that, but you know how different it is now. But it is rather different. And so in 1978, people have noticed that there was a large increase in women working, especially with young children, children of preschool age. Around that time, and the Census Bureau called me up one day and asked me why. Did I know why that was? And I said, yeah, I know why that is. That's because the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed in 1978, which said to employers, you know that Civil Rights Act we have, 1964, actually it includes not discriminating against pregnant women or women of who have just had children. And of course that discrimination still goes on today, but at least it changed a lot at that time. And so there has definitely been less discrimination. We see more women working, and we see fewer men working. And you know that, I think, is primarily a sign of being a wealthier society, because men can afford not to work. They can go to school, stay in school longer. They can retire earlier. But you do notice an interesting thing is that in most of the blue lines, the labor force participation of women continues to increase in the recessions, but men's falls in almost every recession. And in this last recession, men's labor force participation fell several percentage points, and women's also fell. And it was almost the first time ever that women's labor force participation has fallen in a recession. And you can partly see the reason for that. What we had was a long-term secular trend of an increase in women working, and it topped out at about 1998 or 2000, and since then it's been pretty flat. So given that that growth was not continuing, then it's not too surprising that when the recession hit, women did drop out of the labor force, much as men have always done. Another good positive sign, besides that increased labor force participation of women, is this general equalizing of the wages of men and women. Women's wages have continued to increase during this whole time, which is 1960 to 2009. A lot of that is because more and more of them have been working. They've been getting more labor market experience. They're increasing their human capital. They're getting more education. But as I just mentioned, also, I think the anti-discrimination laws have helped women. Well, what's been happening to men? Kind of a depressing picture. From about 1973, there's the peak there for men's wages. This is in real earnings, so it's adjusted for inflation. If it weren't adjusted for inflation, it would look like it was going up all this time. But this is adjusted for inflation. Men's real earnings in the United States have really been flat. And I think we're, you know, thanks to the Occupy Wall Street movement, we're hearing a lot more about that than we used to hear. And it's really about the growth of inequality. If we divide up this line for men and women by education, we would see that college-educated men, their real earnings have continued to grow. But for lesser-educated men, their real earnings have actually fallen. So there has been rising inequality, and it has definitely had a negative impact on those with less education. This is just showing, breaking down those data for women and men by race, racial groups. So you can see white men, Asian men are the highest earning. Then we have black men, Hispanic men in the chart. Then white women, Asian American women, black women, and Hispanic women. Hispanic women are in the least. Asian American women out-earn white women. You may know the name Jared Bernstein. He used to work at the Economic Policy Institute. Then he went to work for the Obama administration for Vice President Biden. And now he's on at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. But you often see him on various television shows talking about the economy. And one year when the wage gap data were particularly bad, we thought the wage gap was going to get narrower that year. And it got wider, and we were trying to figure out why. And Jared said, and look at these Asian American women. They out-earn white women. What's going on? And we looked into it, and it turned out that Asian American women would earn as little as white women if as many of them went into teaching as white women do. But they don't go into teaching, so their wages are higher. So women's occupations typically do tend to pay less than those same women could earn somewhere else. So this is some real wages from 1979 to 2008, broken down by education level. So the top line is men who have more than high school, so college or some college. And you can see their real wages have grown over this period. The red line is women with more than high school, and you can see their wages have also grown. Now, a difference is that women with high school or below, the golden line at the bottom, their real wages have actually risen during this period. But for men with that education level, their real wages have fallen. I think the men have been, you know, particularly hit by the attack on unions, on labor unions, and the disappearance of manufacturing jobs in the United States. So it's really the men with less education that have been hit the hardest by, in terms of change in wages. But of course, the men in both groups still out-earn the women in both groups. And again, those vertical bars are the recessions. So when you break, on the whole, it looks like women have been doing reasonably well. Men's real wages haven't been so great. Women are participating more in the labor force. So it looks like women are doing pretty well. But remember that for both men and women, it's whites and Asian Americans and the college educated that are doing better than the others in both genders. The other area in which women has made progress, that first slide mentioned labor force participation, wage gains, and occupational segregation. This index of occupational segregation, which is the one most commonly used, shows really a steady decline in segregation. The black line is average for everybody in the labor force. So it has declined from about 70% to about 50%, up to about the mid-90s. And what that measure means is that in order for women and men to be exactly distributed in the labor market across the same occupations, in the old days, 70% of men or women would have had to change jobs. Today, it's only 50%. So yes, you still see a lot of segregation in the labor market. Men are truck drivers, women are secretaries, women are nurses, and so on. Men are construction workers. Men repair highways, and women are the home health aides, for example, is a female-dominated job. So this segregation is, I think, another, it's again something that is attacked with our civil rights laws, but we seem to have made much less progress in ending segregation, especially for those with less than 4 years of college. So the red line, the higher degree of segregation, that is those who do not have a college education. The pinkish line is those who do have a college education. So it's fallen much faster for those with a college education. And, again, just most of the jobs I think that we think of that are integrated now, we might think doctor, lawyer. When I was graduating from college, very, very few women went into law or medical school. My husband's entering class at Yale, I think, had in the law school, maybe had 6 women in it. In the class before, had 2 or 3. And the class afterward had 10 or 12. Rapid rate of growth, but not very many out of, 165 or whatever it was. So, we can all think of occupations that are integrated now. Journalist, TV anchor, never before female. TV reporter, not female when I was growing up. Bus driver, never saw any women. So there are some blue-collar jobs like bus driver. A mail carrier, you see women in that field now. There used to be no women in that field. So again, progress, but it stopped. So you can see sort of a common theme in all of these graphs. Yes, we've made progress, but it's kind of slowed down since mid-90s, 2000, and the 2000s, and we're really not making, as women in the labor market, the same kind of forward progress that we were. This just shows some major industries by women and men, and you can see that the men are in the yellow down at the bottom there in operators, fabricators, laborers, precision production, craft and repair. Those are dominated by men. And the technical sales and administrative support, the second line, is dominated by women. Services, one of the middle lines, 17% of women are in that, 10% of men. And managers and professionals is pretty equal between men and women. So emphasizing again that the integration has occurred there at the upper end. So now I'm going to go back to some of these other slides. So an interesting thing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about poverty now and how much we have of it and where it comes from. And point out that for women in particular, the nature of their family structure is very important to whether or not they are poor. Let's start with this graph here. This is showing how many men and women are poor at each age group. The first group is 5 to 17. Even there are more women poor than men. 17.8% of women were poor in 2008 versus 17.6% for, I shouldn't say men, really boys, girls and boys. The next chart, 18 to 24, whopping difference between the genders for poverty. 21% of women, only 16% of men. 25 to 34, 16% of women, only 10% of men. 35 to 44, still more women poor. It gets more equal in the Middle Ages, and then it increases again for women relative to men. Does anybody know why women between 18 and 34 are especially likely to be poor? pregnancy and childbirth. They have children. So if you're not married and you're earning some money, chances are when you have a child, you'll earn a bit less money. You'll take some time off. You'll then have to pay for childcare too. And the way the Census Bureau, you know, calculates poverty, it's based on the number of people in the household. So if you had your wage and you weren't poor when it was just you, but you were near poverty and now you have a child, now you're going to be poor. And you actually are poor because you have all these extra expenses and you don't have the money to cover them. So let's also, and then in old age, it's because women live longer than men. Typically, the married couple has spent down the assets. Often the man has had an illness, and the woman is left with very little when her husband dies. So it's at the younger ages and at the older ages that women are more poor. Why are women more poor at 5 to 17? This apparently is because my great profession, economics, has discovered that men are more likely to get divorced if the only children involved are female. And so then there's a certain number of families, that more families with female children that don't have male incomes as compared to families with male children only. So this is showing us how our country has done in trying to combat poverty over the last 50, 60 years. It's from 1959 to 2010, so that's 50 years. And one of the things we can see about this is that always the poverty... supposed to be a red light here. Anybody see my red light? Anybody see it? I don't. Oh, there it is. There it is. There it is. Okay. Yay. All right. In the recession of the 70s, the poverty went up. Recession of the 80s, which was a deep one, poverty went up a lot. We can look at the poverty rate. That would be a little bit more accurate. Goes up in the recessions. Tends to go up, continue to go up after the recession. Big boom, 90s was a big boom. Poverty went down substantially. That was just about our lowest poverty rate, about the same as it was over here in the 70s. And this is where we started out. The war on poverty was right in here. The Johnson years, Medicare, Medicaid. And we see poverty going up in this Bush recession. From Bush 1 to Bush 2, we get this recession here. Or, yeah, what happened there? That was, Clinton to Bush right there. That was a dot-com bubble burst. You see poverty going up. But here, this is bad. Here you're looking at our little boom in the 2000s. It wasn't much of a boom, and poverty continued to go up. Just went down a little bit before it really went up in this recession. So here we are at a 15.1% rate in 2010. And it's, you know, not much better than it's been. We haven't made much progress in the last 30 years, and we're right about back to where we were before we started the war on poverty. And we have a growing population, so that translates into more people in poverty. And you can see how steeply it rose in the recession. And this is an interesting analysis that was done by Larry Michel at the Economic Policy Institute in their book that they do every couple of years, The State of Working America. They looked at all the contributions to poverty between 1969 and 2006, so slightly shorter set of years. And the biggest increase in poverty is due to the increase in inequality. The next biggest one is family structure. You will typically hear, well, if there weren't so many single mothers, we wouldn't have so much poverty. So that is a contributor, 3.3%. This is race, an increase in our minority population. That's increased poverty. Economic growth reduces poverty, almost canceled out. The fact that the growth was unequal kind of made it neutral, right? Unequal growth created poverty. Growth eliminated poverty, so we came out even. Education reduced poverty. So the change in poverty is largely coming from, on the bad side, inequality, family structure. On the good side, economic growth and increased education. So I want to take a look next at this chart is from another study we did using a longitudinal data set where we looked at women and men over 15 years. And in that data set, we found that women earn less than men in every year they work. These are average annual earnings for men and women. So when you look at that first graph, women's wages rising, that's only looking at women who work full-time every year. This is looking at what women actually do over a 15-year period. And over a 15-year period, they're not earning very much compared to the typical man in the labor market. And one of the reasons is that they are spending more time out of the labor market. Well, why are they spending more time out of the labor market? Because they're raising children. So we have 84% of men not taking even 1 year off in a 15-year period, but half of women do. And this was from 1983 to 1998. The 15-year period before, it was like two-thirds of women who took a year off. So this we did see women increasing their labor force participation during this period, but they're still taking more time off than men. And here's 30% of women take at least 4 years off compared to only 4% of men. So the family rearing that women do and the family structure, you know, definitely affects the jobs they can get and where they work and what they do. So this is just showing you where the low-wage jobs are in our economy. Wholesale and retail trade is the biggest one. Where this little dot is. Here we go. And over here you see leisure and hospitality. This is restaurants, hotels, and so on. Big generators of low-wage work. Also, interestingly, education and health services generates a lot of high-wage work, the black line, but also a lot of low-wage work. So many of us, I certainly started out in babysitting and waitressing, and so I was here. And many people also work in retail trade. And some of these jobs, you know, are for us as young people, and we go to college and we move on and we get better jobs. But unfortunately, a lot of people do not move on. One of the things when we did this particular study of low-wage work, we looked at where women and men are working and what kind of credentials they need. And we basically found that in these very low-wage jobs that women do, they actually need a lot of credentials compared to the low-wage jobs that men do. So childcare worker, hairdresser, cosmetologist, teacher assistants, these are the kinds of low-wage jobs that women have, and you could see that they needed credentials. Here, some men's low-wage jobs where the vast proportion of the people who are in these jobs are men. The last group we looked at, vast proportion were female. Same type of wages, no credentials for the men, and except here for security guards. So one of the things we made a point of saying is that, yes, there is a low-wage labor market, but in the low-wage labor market, women's wages are even lower than men's for the type of credentials that are needed. And, you know, we had a whole effort in the 80s to deal with this problem of jobs that are typed as women's jobs, and we called it comparable worth or pay equity. And it really didn't go anywhere. We had some victories with some state civil services raising the wages of female-dominated jobs. But without labor unions in those jobs, without collective bargaining power or political power, it's very hard to do anything to bring up the wages of those jobs. So the women are in these female-dominated low-wage jobs, and they are particularly low-wage. And they stay in them much longer than men. One of the things our studies showed is that 90% of people who averaged low wages over 15 years were women. Only 10% of people who averaged low wages over 15 years were men. We also found in the same study that those who rarely in the 15 years, they had very few years with children, they made more money than those who had children if they were women. Women made less money when they had children, some of the years, most of the years, no years. Men made more money when they had children, no children, some of the years they have children, all the years they have children in this particular study. And this has been found time and time again, that somehow having responsibilities for family tends to raise men's wages and it lowers women's wages. And this shows the same thing. The more men are married, the more earnings they have, the brown line, the more in the study that women were married, the lower their earnings were. So family structure and having children definitely has an impact on women's wages. And those are, you know, perhaps hard things to address. So what are the consequences of low lifetime earnings for women? Certainly, as I mentioned, inadequate retirement income for women. Half of women over 65 live alone, 20% are poor. And also we should point out restricted opportunities for both women and men, because men tend to work more hours when children are born. And the research shows that more dads than moms would actually like to spend more time with their kids, and that is hard to do in the kinds of jobs they have. And of course, we have more poor children because women cannot support children adequately on the women's wages that they earn in women's jobs. So if they're not married, it's difficult for them to earn enough money to support children. As we saw, the poverty rates are quite high for women in their 20s and 30s. So go skip that one, go to this one. So I've emphasized marital structure. I just want to mention it again. So here is the poverty status of married couples with children. It's 6.5% if they have children, 3.1% without children. Those may be older, more established couples. After their children are over 18, you're not counted anymore as children in the census data. Single women with kids, 36% are poor. Single women without kids, only 10%. Single men with kids, 18% are poor. Only 7% are poor if they don't have children. So the single men are doing better than the single women, but being a single parent is difficult for both. So this, again, is just emphasizing that connection. It's not that I'm telling you to run out and get married. I'm just pointing this out. This is the same kind of thing. It shows that among lower-income families, these are the bottom two income quintiles, most of the many of the people in those families are female householders no husband. As income goes up, the share of people in those households who are female-headed goes down, and the share who are married couples go up. This is actually the number of families, so it's not really the share. So there are many more married couples in the higher-income families, many fewer single adults, male or female. So high income is associated now with marrying, and low income is associated with not marrying. And that certainly contributes to the poverty problem. But as we saw, that change in family structure isn't really the main determinant of the increase in poverty. So the third topic, I just want to look at the recession and some of our work in that area, and talk about how men and women are faring in the recession. We found, for example, in a survey we did, I'll leave this at the Clark Forum, about a year and a half ago, we did a survey of 2,700 Americans to find out how they were doing in the recovery. It was about a year and a half after the recovery supposedly started. And we found that 42% of single mothers, for example, reported experiencing unemployment for at least 1 month in the prior 2 years, compared with only 26% of mothers, married mothers, about a quarter of married mothers, a quarter of single women without children, but 42% of single mothers. And they also reported that they had a hard time, much harder time, paying their bills, going to the doctor, paying their rent, highest levels of hardship for single moms. So it was a sobering study, and it's certainly those results have been replicated by many other people. So we know that single mothers are having a particularly hard time. I mentioned the data set that we saved with Senator Kennedy, and this is data from that data set. So we've been tracking this ever since pretty much the recovery started, and what we find is that this is the blue area, that's from here to here, is what we call the men's recession. That's the time period in which men's employment was falling. This is the payroll data. 71 million men were working on payrolls, which is not everybody, but most people, at the start of the, even before the recession, that was the peak. Men's employment was already falling. This down here is the official recession as measured by the National Bureau of Economics Research. So it started in December of 2007, but men's employment was already falling. Women's employment was still rising, and it continued to rise even after the recession started. So the pink area, here to here, is what we call women's recession. That's when their employment fell, and this is where their recovery started. So their recovery started a good 6 months or so after men's. And in terms of employment, they all started about 6 months after the official end of the recession. So employment recovery is not the major thing that the NBER is looking for. They're looking for growth in output. So they say output started to grow here, but it took a very long time for families to see any experience of growth. In terms of the election, the dates down here are all wrong, so that's not going to help us much. But we do know that's January 2007. Okay. I was thinking about Obama. I think his election is right about in here somewhere, isn't it? Yeah, January 08. So his election is right around here, and he takes office right around here, and this is what happens to the economy under his watch. Whammo. Huge drop in employment, the biggest since the 1930s recession. Now, what was going on with women? They didn't lose as many jobs, and men lost 3 out of 4 jobs. Now, men still have not recovered. We still have 8 million people more unemployed, I think, than we did when the recession started. Women haven't recovered. But it turns out that women are recovering fewer of the jobs they lost than our men. So in the recovery, men are doing slightly better, even in compared to what they lost. I mean, if men lost 75% of the jobs, they should get back 75% of the jobs. But given where they are, they've actually recovered more than their share, and women have recovered slightly less than their share. So what is going on? I mean, the simplest answer is to say that, remember that job segregation? Men and women working in different places in the labor market. That's basically what's going on. So a lot of women, especially a lot of professional women, work in the public sector. Especially, for example, if you're looking at college-educated professional women of color, most of them work in the public sector. So what happens is that the public sector actually doesn't lose all its jobs in the beginning. It still has the tax revenues from the year before, and it's still buying services and hiring people. So women's employment fell more slowly than men's. Also, women dominate healthcare. Healthcare is the only industry that grew every month of this recession and recovery, and women dominate that. So between healthcare, education, even when the public sector cuts, they try not to cut education, schools, elementary schools, high schools. That pretty much protected them for a long time. But after several years, those state and local governments are hurting. They all have an obligation to balance their budgets. They start laying off, even teachers, even healthcare workers, office workers, and women have lost the majority of those jobs that have been cut in state and local government. And so women are now not recovering because men have more of the private sector jobs. The private sector is recovering, and the public sector is not recovering. And that is retarding women's employment growth. However, a study of every industry showed that in the recession, women actually were more likely to be laid off than men in every industry. The only reason they didn't lose more jobs overall is that they were in healthcare and education. But they were actually more likely to lose jobs in every industry. And so in some of the integrated industries, they are less likely to get jobs now. But as we say, it's really hard to know the reason for that. I mean, nobody knows. Is that really discrimination? Is it something else? It's really hard to know. This shows the increase in the unemployment rate. What we were looking at was the decrease in employment and the rise in employment. This is the rise in the unemployment rate for women during this big recession here of 2007 to 2009. Steep rise, especially for less than high school. So high unemployment among less than high school. This group is with a high school diploma and some college. An increase in unemployment, but not as bad. This is associate's degree, and this is bachelor's degree. So even though you all have friends who haven't been able to get jobs and are still having trouble finding work, it's much, much better if you have a college degree than if you don't. But this rise in unemployment for every group, what I like to say about this recession was that it was an equal opportunity disemployer, because there was no group that was unaffected by this recession. So here we're taking a look at how our safety net has fared. How have all these poor people done? We've seen the increase in unemployment. We've seen the increase in poverty that happens with a recession. Do any of our programs make any difference? This line down here, this line down here is WIC, the Women and Infants children food program, and it's pretty steadily rising. This is supplementary food for low-income and moderate-income women who are having babies, and it feeds the children up until they're about age 5 or 6. And this is SNAP, and this is the poverty rate, the green line, and you can see it rising during all the recessions. I'm sorry, it's kind of blocked out during this recession, but you can see it up there. It rose steeply, and it tended to fall in the growth periods, except this last period, the growth period, it didn't fall. And what happens with food stamps, that's been our most cyclical, counter-cyclical in the sense that the food spending goes up. See it going up there in the recession? Food spending goes up in the recessions, and so it's counter-cyclical. It's giving people money when they don't have money. And you've heard the Republican candidates refer to Obama as the food stamp president. And I hear that and I say, thank God. What were people going to eat when they didn't have jobs, you know? I mean, to me, that's a great thing that we have food stamps, that somebody at least has a safety net. Because here's what happened to our other safety net. This year, 1996, was the year of welfare reform. This is the number of people on welfare. And in the recession, it tended to go up, went up in this recession. Then it fell in 96, so it didn't go up at all in the early recession, 2001, and it's barely gone up in this recession. You can see that little line there, barely gone up at all, while poverty went up hugely, as we saw on the other graph. So welfare isn't working. That's what happened when we lost that entitlement in 1996. We all predicted, those of us who were fighting to keep that from happening, we all said this would be a bad thing. And it has been a bad thing. If it hadn't been for food stamps, these people would have had very little to live on. This is showing you some of the variation among the states. In this recession, 6 states actually had a caseload decline, 1 by as much as 30%. Most had a small increase, 10 to 20%. And a few had a more substantial increase, but on average, you saw it in that graph. And this is a study from LaDonna Pavetti at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities that she just presented a couple weeks ago. This is from our work, and we thought, well, let's take a long-term look. Let's look at 1997 to 2008, the last 10 years. And if you study our poverty program, you know that what we're doing, and there was a great article about this in the New York Times very recently, and I'm pretty much wrapping up, a couple of weeks ago, talking about how most of our programs are going more toward working people. More of our aid goes to those who work. So they have low wages, they get some income tax credit called the EITC, and that helps them. But those who are very poor, who can't work or don't work, they get nothing or very little. So what you saw is earnings, and this is all poor people, 100% of all poor people, and their earnings share went up until the recession, and now it's going down again because of this recession. Another thing is the TANF. We were just looking at that. That used to be a substantial share of all poor families' income. Now it's almost nothing. These are the food stamps. It went down in the boom of the 90s as a share, but now it's been rising, and it's one of the things that rose in this recession. EITC, its big expansion was in 1996, before this chart starts, which is 1997. This is the earned income tax credit, which does help a lot of low-income families, but its share hasn't really risen. You have to be working to get that EITC. So if you were middle class and your income fell in the recession, you might newly get EITC. But if you lost your job entirely, you would lose your EITC. So in the recession, it tends to balance out. More people get it who didn't get it before, but more people who were getting it lose it. So it doesn't really grow. It isn't really counter-cyclical, and that is a problem. Now, this is our biggest means-tested form of assistance, and it isn't counter-cyclical. It doesn't go up in a recession. The only thing that goes up in a recession is food stamps. So this recession is different from the past ones in that there were many fewer things to help people. But one of the things that was around was unextended unemployment benefits. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to find that, so I'll just go back to here. The One of the things that was in ARRA, the American Recovery Act, I forget what the second R stands for, Reinvestment Act, okay, was the extended unemployment insurance. Not only was it extended, it was made more generous by $25 a week. It was expanded to low-wage workers and part-time workers. And so it made a huge difference. This is where regular unemployment peaked, right at about the official end of the recession was June 09. People have run out of their regular unemployment by then. And if it weren't for this extended unemployment, they would not have had a lot of income. So one of the things we saw in this recession was a tremendous importance of this extended unemployment insurance. This is men, and it doesn't look much different. That sort of surprised us, and I think the fact that women got so much of the aid reflected the reforms, and it also reflected how much more low-income women had been working because of welfare reform and because of the boom of the 90s, so that, that unemployment insurance has gone equally to women and men. This is just showing you the unemployment rates for single mothers. You can see how high they are even today, 15% for single mothers, 6.1% for married mothers, 8.6% for all women. So they have needed the unemployment insurance, and they have gotten a fair amount of it. Oh, this is the graph just showing us who got income from what during the period before the recession, starting, this is from IWPR, starting in 2006, the year before, and going to 2010. So these are the single moms. You can see how much their earnings declined, how much the share of them with earnings declined during the recession, from about 80% down to 75%. For married moms, it's not too big a decline from before the recession to after the recession. It's about one percentage point, actually, in the last 2 years, anyway, in the recovery. And, I'm sorry, married mothers are up here. Sorry, that was all women. This is the married mothers. It's only 1% for them over the course of this recession and recovery. So more of them are working. The non-married mothers, the single mothers, have really lost more of the jobs in this recession. So, and then this is income from social programs. And this is, pretty much where I'm ending. Here we can see the married mothers, their income from social insurance programs. It's mostly unemployment insurance, includes Social Security for older people, but for the married mothers, it's mostly unemployment insurance. So you can see how much they got. And for the non-married mothers, they got an increase too, but not quite as big an increase as the married moms got. Probably the married moms had better jobs, higher earnings, and got more unemployment insurance. More of them got unemployment insurance. You have to earn usually a substantial amount to qualify for it. But you can see that it's 15 to 16% of all married mothers and non-mothers who were getting unemployment insurance. So that's pretty good. So it was very important to a very important part of the safety net. So these were some of the things that were in the stimulus bill that could potentially help women. There was they did expand access to TANF during the recession. It made some difference in some states. They expanded food stamps, WIC, Medicaid, unemployment insurance. There was employment generation, and some of it was where women work, aid to the states for schools, Head Start, and child care. Obama's economic team estimated that about 42% of the employment created by the stimulus would go to women. Nobody's checked that yet. I haven't seen any research on that, so I don't know whether or not that was true. And this, I think, is where the Obama administration did the least well in terms of efforts to increase credit and assist those facing mortgage problems. I talked about the importance of UI, and this is from a paper from people at Congressional Research Service, and it shows basically how much it lifted people above poverty. So a lot of unemployment insurance goes to people who aren't poor, but it was a huge anti-poverty program. All these people here were lifted out of, all these people here were children lifted out of poverty by unemployment insurance. So it's about 2.5 million adults and another million children all lifted out of poverty by unemployment insurance. So the expansion of that program was probably one of the best things in the ARRA. This is now my last slide, finally, and just talk about a whole range of things that we would need to do. I pointed out that those with better education earn more, had more real earnings gains over the last 30 or 40 years, had less unemployment. So anything we can do to improve educational access for low-income students is very important. And on that score, we need to support student parents because most low-income students have children already, and we're not doing very much of that. I mentioned EEO enforcement, or the importance of all of our equal employment opportunity legislation. I think enforcement going there would do us a lot of good. And as I noted, we haven't done much in the less than college educated in the blue-collar jobs, and we should do more there. I mentioned a couple of times the importance of collective bargaining. I think we might also mention the minimum wage. It does not keep up with inflation. It is not very high in this country. Somebody was telling me that the minimum wage in Australia is $12 an hour. That's more typical in European countries, that it's much higher than it is here. And I think we do need to have things that lift the floor. I mentioned the importance to women of children and family care. And so everything we could do to improve work and family policies would be good. We did, in that survey I mentioned, we asked people, do you have flexible work arrangements? Who are the workers with the least flexible work arrangements? Single moms. Who are the workers with the most flexible work arrangements? White men. The higher paid your job, the more flexible it is. The lower paid your job, the less flexible it is. So the very people who need the most flexibility have it the least at work. And I would add political engagement. I know this election season makes it look like maybe it's not such a good idea, really, to get involved in politics, but really you should. You should run for office. Because that's the only way to get these things, to get better work and family policies, to get a better floor, to get more EEO, and to get more educational equity. You have to get out there, vote, and run for office. And we still need to do more to speed our recovery. It's way too slow. We are now on this thing of austerity, cut budgets, cut government spending. That's exactly the wrong way to go. The federal government right now is a macroeconomic drag on our economy. It is holding back economic growth because it's already cutting back on spending, and that is the wrong thing for it to be doing. So we're kind of lucky that we're doing as well as we are, because it isn't because federal spending is too big. If anything, federal spending is too small. So I'm going to end there, and I know Max or someone is going to come up and do the Q&A, and I can take a few questions, even though I realize it's late. I'm happy to take a few questions. Thank you.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Please raise your hand and the microphone will be brought to you.
Okay, so right now we're dealing with a political spectrum, and particularly on the Republican side. I'm not sure if you followed the Romney proposals in terms of the tax plan, but he's proposing drastically cutting the EITC. He says he's not that concerned about the poor. The safety net is just fabulous. And I find myself having difficulty with this, both as the child of a single-parent mother who never went to college, but also as someone who, you know, advocates a strong safety net. How do we... You know, we're in the ivory tower right now. How do we take this to the boulevard? Right? How do we kind of sell these solutions on the streets? Because I'm happy to do so. But if you have any directions, I'm all ears.
Well, I wish I had some directions on how we could build more popular support for basically economic security proposals. You know, more aid for higher education, I think, is very important. I don't really see why middle-class families should get as little aid as they get in other countries. I was just reading about Scotland. Higher education is completely free in Scotland. Pretty cool. So I don't really think there's any need for us to be as stingy as we are with our aid. But being more generous would require a bigger public sector and would require higher tax rates. And some people say, you know, that Europe has more of its economy in the public sector because tax rates are higher, and that's because they have the value-added tax, which is a kind of hidden tax. You know, if you travel and you buy a really expensive souvenir, like let's say a really nice hand-knit sweater in Sweden, you can go to the airport and you can get your value-added tax back. And it's pretty substantial. We don't have that. We have a sales tax, which is visible and which you see it. Nobody tells you how much the value-added tax is in Sweden until you go to the airport and find out what it is. So if you live there, you never find out because you never go to the airport because you're never living in the country, so you don't know. So, but other people say, well, it's because they have a more communitarian philosophy, they have a higher tolerance for helping each other, they have a higher tolerance for paying taxes, and that's why they invented the value-added tax. So it's really hard to know whether it's people's different feelings about things or the mechanisms or what it is. But I do think that we really have to have a major change in this country to really deal with the inequality we've been experiencing, the growth in poverty. To me, it's just completely unacceptable for a civilized society. I can't understand how anyone tolerates it. And obviously, we haven't made good enough arguments to really convince people that this is the way to go. So I think we need a different vision of what an economy is about. It's to help people, and a different vision of what makes it hum and what makes it work well. And we're now having studies showing that inequality reduces economic growth. High inequality reduces economic growth, so it's bad for everyone. The investment that you could make in children for childcare would be something like, you know, return on investment would be $10 for every dollar you spend. I mean, why aren't we doing more of that? So we are seeing more economic arguments for why we should reduce inequality, why we should invest in young children, why we should invest in reducing poverty. Poverty increases our healthcare costs. People use the emergency room because they can't go anywhere else. If they use the emergency room, they're paying about double what they would pay if they could go to a doctor. They don't go to a doctor, they go to the emergency room. Now they're going to the emergency room for dental care because dentists won't take Medicaid because the Medicaid reimbursement rates are too low. So all the stinginess that we do, all of it is really costing us more money. And I don't know why but I'm really too much of an economist. I mean, I always think of it this way, you know, costs and benefits. And I think maybe for many people, we need to maybe focus on moral arguments or other arguments. But we've definitely kind of lost that battle. And I think we need to start over, re-engage, figure out a new way to try to do it. But I don't have any good answers for you.
I guess the question that I have is, we're in the recovery period now, but do you think that it's possible for a single mother to go to night class because she still has to work, but do you think that going to classes at night and stuff like that is still a possibility, I guess, for single parents to try to better themselves while trying to support their family during this recovery period?
Absolutely, and many single mothers are doing exactly that. It's just that it's very hard for them because they don't have enough help with childcare. The number of childcare slots on campuses has actually fallen in the last 10 years, according to one of the studies that we've done. So there's actually less help for them. But one of the things that did happen in the ARRA was the increase in the size of Pell Grants. So that did create more loans, you know, more money available, more grants and more loans also became available for low-income people. And then you saw some preying or targeting of some of the for-profit sort of fly-by-night educational companies targeting single mothers, saying, you can get a loan, go to school, President Obama wants you to go to school, get a loan. And a lot of people think that those loans are all going to, be unpaid. However, because we've changed the bankruptcy law, you can't discharge your student loans in a bankruptcy the way you can discharge other loans. So that was something that happened that we probably need to reverse. Because if you've got the education and you still can't get a job or make money, you sure shouldn't have to pay back the loan. So, but no, many, many single mothers are doing exactly that. And I think it is a great thing to do, but it is very difficult. You have a job, you're raising kids on your own, and you're trying to go to school. But nevertheless, a lot of them do it. So it's incredible to me how many do it.
Can you say a little bit about why you choose to use a gender lens in your work, or why the Institute chooses to use a gender lens, what you think it contributes?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Why do you choose to use a gender lens in your work? Or why does the Institute take a gender approach? Or can you say a little bit about what you think that contributes?
Well, I guess my idea was that we were missing that type of public policy analysis. I spent a lot of time in Washington. I moved to Washington in 1976. I started the Institute in 1987. I had spent time at the Civil Rights Commission. I had spent time at the National Academy of Sciences. And I didn't see a lot of public policy analysis from a gendered point of view. For example, in Europe now, you will see gender budget analysis. And countries all around the world are analyzing every year their annual budget. What's its impact on men and women? We don't do that in the United States. Europe, the European Union has gender mainstreaming. It's supposed to be present in all of their national governments. We don't have a concept like that in the U.S. government. And so I saw in Washington public policy being made without any attention to the gender impact of the public policy changes. And as a feminist scholar, women's studies person, I just thought, well, that's nuts. We need to have a capacity to do this kind of analysis. And to some extent, we've made a dent. Now you'll see what I call the boys' think tanks or the co-ed think tanks. They're doing some gender studies and some women's studies, and the Urban Institute did for a while. Every now and then, Brookings will do something. So we're having some impact, but we're far, I think, from having a field, for example, of gendered public policy analysis. Gender and women isn't really a field in schools of public policy. So it was really because of what I saw as a lack in the United States and a need that needed to be filled, and some demand. If many women members of Congress, many male members of Congress are very interested in being elected, and they know women vote more than men, and they want to know, what can they come up with that will help women? It's not that they don't want to help men. They want to help men. It's kind of like saying, well, we need civil rights because we need to do more for our minorities. Yeah, that's true, because most of our policies are already doing a lot for the majority. So it's not that we want to ignore men or ignore the majority, but the feeling that certain people are being left out of progress, of economic growth, and we need to include them. So it's really an analysis that says we should look at differences and differential impacts.
Hello.
Oh, okay. So earlier you gave the example of Sweden or with the free education? No, it was in another country. I'm sorry. Scotland, excuse me. What do you think is the biggest block from our country adapting foreign examples that we see very effective? Is it mostly cultural differences and political stigma, or is it mainly economics or a combination of the two?
I don't really know. I mean, we have a very big country. It is very diverse. And we have one of the most diverse countries racially, ethnically, religious-wise of anywhere in the world. We have a frontier mentality. People left other countries to come here, some not by choice, others by their own choice. And they found, this... Once they got rid of the Native Americans, they found this very empty country. And it'll, the divorce, there's studies now of how did people divorce in the 19th century? Oh, the men just went west, and left their families behind. So I like to call what we have cowboy capitalism. It's very much about free will, individualism. You can do anything you want, build anything you want, anywhere you want, destroy any land that you can, any resources, natural resources. If it's on your land, it's yours. Just take it And this is not the way other people live. My family is from Germany. I frequently go back and visit my cousins there. And, it's a lot more regulated. It's a lot more controlled. It's a lot more community-oriented. And we have a sort of anti-regulation bias and clearly an anti-tax bias. And, I just find it hard to understand. Canada, to our north, doesn't seem to have quite that same ideology that we have. They're much more focused on being orderly. They did not have the big real estate bust that we had because they have more financial regulation up there. So it's not just about moving to a new continent, because the Canadians did that too. So I really don't know what explains it all. But it's something we have to figure out, an American solution that appeals to people. And I think really the Occupy Wall Street movement has been the best thing to come along, because the focus on the 99% versus the 1%, I think, is a very simple message. And all these people, as you can see in the data, are being left out of economic growth. It's not that we haven't had some economic growth, but we've had it very much for the people at the very top.
Hi. How do you feel about, I was reading an article a few months ago about tuition prices are predicted to almost double.
I'm sorry, an article about what?
Tuition prices are predicted to almost double within the next 25 to 50 years. Like us as students now, when we have kids, a lot of higher education prices are going to be almost double what they are now. Do you think the government is going to step in or need to step in at some point to kind of stop?
Oh, about tuition doubling?
Yeah, tuition mm-hmm. hikes. And what does this say? Because I noticed that education obviously plays a huge factor in people's wages and unemployment. So if you could talk a little bit about those predictions, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. traditionally has had a high regard for education. We were one of the very first countries to have public education. If you're an economist and you know Bob Solow's work, Nobel laureate, one day he said to me, "Oh, come on, Heidi, you don't think if we didn't have public education already that we would do it now, do you?" So that's a kind of sobering, sad thing. In other words, you know, the free market ideology has gotten so strong that our commitment to public education from the colonial era in the 19th century in particular, we would somehow kill now. So I think that although traditionally we have had a high public investment in education in this country, we are falling behind now. We have fewer college people attending college and graduating college than many other wealthy countries. We have less investment in early childhood education than many other countries. And both of those things are very important to success. So I think that we've relied on the private sector in higher education a bit too much. And one of the things that has happened in this crisis, in this recession and recovery, is of course at the state and public institutions, the tuitions are going up sky high because, again, they have to balance their state budget, tax revenues fell, they don't want to raise tax rates on the very rich, who are the only people with money, so they cut their budgets and it's affecting the budgets for public education. I think we have to have more investment in public education. One way to do it would be to reduce our investment in armaments, often called defense, but we have very few enemies right now, and it's just a question. No other country spends as much on defense. In fact, the United States, I believe, spends as much on defense as every other country in the world added up together. So unless they all gang up on us, we really have enough stuff there to fight them off. So I think that that is a huge cost for the American economy, which people don't even talk about anymore. But it, certainly, if we want to invest more in things like childcare, healthcare, college education, we need to limit our defense expenditures. Will the government step in? Well, it depends how many of you are going to vote and how are you going to vote. So, you know, there are, of course, restrictions on our democracy and limits on our democracy. Political funding is a huge problem in this election. But it still makes a difference how much you organize, how much you vote, and how much you get other people to come out and vote. But actually, I am an eternal optimist. I do believe we are going to have a stronger public sector. I think if nothing else, this period of economic history shows how much we need it. And I think we, in fact, will turn around and start investing more in childcare, in education, in healthcare. I do think that's in our future in the next 20 or 30 years. I do. I'm a nut, but I believe that.
Please join me in thanking Ms. Harbin. This concludes tonight's presentation. Thank you for coming.